This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 734 people have now died globally as a result of the COVID-19 virus. It's more than 163,000 in the United States, more than 101,000 in Brazil. No other country comes close. The number of worldwide infections has hit another milestone, this time 20 million and climbing. The highest numbers are in the U.S., Brazil, and India together, making up more than half of the global infections. The International Committee of the Red Cross said Monday that the frontline health workers in Brazil are at serious risk of contracting COVID-19 as they carry out essential work. The organization announced a campaign Monday to support essential workers there. The Brazilian Health Ministry said that approximately 233,000 health professionals have been diagnosed with COVID-19, and around 200 of those have died of it, but the number is believed to be much higher. In fact, Brazil's Federal Council of Nursing says that it has recorded more than 300 COVID-19-related deaths within the nursing profession alone. Vilified, threatened with violence, and in some cases suffering from burnout, dozens of state and local public health leaders around the United States have resigned or have been fired amid the coronavirus outbreak, a testament to how politically combustible masks, lockdowns, and infection data have become. One of the latest departures came Sunday when California's public health director, Dr. Sonia Angel, was ousted following a technical glitch that caused a delay in reporting hundreds of thousands of virus test results, information used to make decisions about reopening businesses and schools there. Last week, New York City's health commissioner was replaced after months of friction with the police department and City Hall. And local government officials across the U.S. have been on edge for months about how to keep basic services running while covering rising costs related to the coronavirus outbreak. This is VOA News. Lebanon's prime minister stepped down from his job Monday in the wake of the catastrophic explosion in Beirut that triggered public outrage, saying that he has come to the conclusion that corruption in the country is bigger than the state. The move risks opening the way to dragged-out negotiations over a new cabinet amid urgent calls for reform. It follows a weekend of anti-government protests after the August 4th explosion in Beirut's port that decimated the facility and caused widespread destruction, killing at least 160 people and injuring about 6,000 others. In a brief televised speech after three of his ministers resigned, the Prime Minister Hassan Diab said that he and his government were stepping down. Hong Kong's Apple Daily tabloid responded with defiance Tuesday to the arrest of owner Jimmy Lai under a new national security law imposed by Beijing. In a front page headline above an image of Lai in handcuffs, it read, "Apple Daily must fight on." The paper said on its website that more than 500,000 copies were printed, up from the usual 100,000. Lai was detained over suspected collusion with foreign forces, as about 200 police searched the newspaper's office, collecting 25 boxes of evidence. His arrest comes amid a crackdown against pro-democracy opposition in Hong Kong, which has drawn international condemnation and raised fears for the freedoms promised by Beijing when the former British colony returned to China in 1997. The sweeping new security law imposed on June 30th punishes anything Beijing considers secession, subversion, terrorism, or collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday he will make his Republican presidential renomination acceptance speech from either the White House or at a Civil War battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. With the coronavirus pandemic unchecked in the U.S., neither Mr. Trump nor his Democratic opponent in the November 3rd former Vice President Joe Biden is planning to make a traditional nomination acceptance speech at either of their respective scale-back conventions. Biden last week said he would make his August 20th nominations acceptance speech from his home of Delaware rather than go to the convention site in the Midwestern city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden is said to have interviewed the finalists to be his running mate, and his campaign is readying to announce his choice. Biden and his potential vice president will formally accept the party's nomination at the Democratic National Convention scheduled for August 17th through 20th, and he's expected to announce his pick before that begins. The New York Times reported earlier Monday that Biden's campaign plans to announce a decision as soon as Tuesday, or more likely on Wednesday, citing people briefed onto the selection process. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UN Secretary General condemned the killing of 8 people in Niger.
This is a major setback for Niger. Both the U.S. and France have been training, advising, and providing equipment to Niger forces, but having a strong security forces doesn't happen overnight or even a decade, which is the case for Niger.
A Ugandan opposition leader says President Yoweri Museveni will lose next year's election. Lawyers petition Zimbabwe's High Court to restore prisoner rights to a jailed journalist. And Malawi's High Court orders the Electoral Commission to pay the legal fees of President Chakwera and Vice President Chilima.
I think the clear message that is sending is that I think public officers, public institutions need to be very careful in the way they discharge their mandate, especially when they're making critical decisions around whether to go for court mitigation over an issue.
South African innovators tackle COVID risks in the humble minibus taxi. And we'll take a look at women incarceration in Sierra Leone. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned the brutal killing of 6 French aid workers and their local guide and driver. He called on Nigerian authorities to spare no effort in identifying and swiftly bringing the perpetrators to justice. French President Emmanuel Macron has also condemned the attack, which took place outside the capital Niamey in an area popular with tourists for its wildlife. As Nicolas Pinault reports from Paris, the attack is a major blow to Niger, a key ally for the U.S. and others in the fight against extremism in the Sahel.
The attack took place in Kouré, only 40 miles from Niger's capital, Niamey. French aid group ACTED said several of its workers were among those killed during a tourist outing. France confirmed its nationals were among the dead. It is believed to be the first such attack on Westerners in this area of Niger, a popular tourist attraction thanks to its unique population of West African or Niger giraffes. Speaking to VOA from Dakar, Gilles Yabi, the founder of WATI, a civil society organization that described itself as a citizen think tank in West Africa, said this attack is not a surprise in this unstable region that Sahel has become over the years.
This is definitely a blow to the effort that have been made so far to bring security in Niger. But in the entire region of Sahel, we do know that attacks can happen basically everywhere. Areas that are more exposed than others, areas where you have a proliferation of armed groups, but it is very easy for some of these armed groups to move from one area to another.
In a recent interview with VOA, J. Peter Pham, the top U.S. envoy to the Sahel region, noted extremist attacks in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger had increased 40% in the first quarter of this year alone. With foreign troops on its soil and a U.S. drones base set up in the northern Nigerian region of Agadez, Niger puts security at the core of its cooperation with Western powers. Yet, the country seems unable to prevent those attacks, said Ridal Yamori, a senior fellow at the Policy Center for the New South.
This is a major setback for Niger, a major ally to the U.S., France, and European Union in general. So both the U.S. and France have been training, advising, and providing equipment to Niger forces. But having a strong security forces doesn't happen overnight or even a decade, which is the case for Niger.
The office of President Emmanuel Macron said he spoke on the phone with his Niger counterpart, Mahamadou Issoufou. Both leaders condemned what Mr. Macron described as a cowardly attack, and one that could renew a political debate in Niger, according to Sadi Kaba, a Nigerian journalist based in Paris.
Ce qui vient de se passer à Kouré va remettre au centre du débat politique.
He explains that what happened in Kouré will make security the focus of the political debate in Niger, even over President Issoufou's track record and the value of foreign troops on Niger soil. He mentions that French, U.S. and even German troops are stationed in Niger. Sahel has become a haven for Sahel jihadist groups, such as the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, ISGS. A number of Europeans have been abducted and in some cases killed in the volatile region. Two Frenchmen, Antoine Delacour and Vincent Delarue, were killed after being kidnapped by jihadists from a restaurant in Niamey in 2011. Nicholas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Malawi's High Court says the country's Electoral Commission, also known as MEC, should pay President Lazarus Chakwera and Vice President Saulos Chilima over 5 billion Malawi kwachas, about $6 million, as legal fees incurred when the two challenged in court the results of the May 2019 presidential election. The MEC and President Peter Mutharika's then-ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, were the first and second respondents in the court challenge. Malawi Governance Commentator Makumbo Mutale says the ruling means that Malawi taxpayers are going to foot the bill for MEC's mistakes.
I think it's not surprising that we have this ruling. It's something that was really indicated after the initial ruling that the court would still sit down and come up with the actual cost that Malawi Electoral Commission should pay to these two individuals. Maybe the only difference is that the context is one that has changed, where now Chilima and Chakwera are now in the government, and like the time when they were in the opposition. So maybe in terms of now how maybe the public is really looking at the issue, I think it looked negatively in terms of that it's the taxpayer who have to pay on the mistakes that were made by individual commissioners of Malawi Electoral Commission.
Exactly so, because I'm looking at it, the Malawi Elections Commission is a government institution. So if the court says this, is the government punishing itself?
Exactly. Basically, that's how one would look at it. At the very same time, you'd also want to look at that from the angle that the Chakwera and Chilima, who had actually petitioned the court in their individual capacities as leaders of the opposition, were satisfied with the election. So you wouldn't actually deny them the right to actually access the money that they spent actually following the court charges that they've just made to make. So from the legal point of view, there is completely nothing wrong. The only difference is maybe the context. But however, this issue raises maybe an area of debate in terms of the law reform. Maybe currently there's a discussion that maybe those that have made, those public servants that have made decisions that have no clear basis by taking the legal path, maybe they should now start paying personally the cost that the court may charge them, rather than the public institution itself being the one paid. So that's maybe an area that is currently people are beginning to debate on, looking at the current situation, which definitely will have a big burden on the taxpayer who definitely did not participate in the decision that the Malawi Electoral Commission had made.
On the other hand, it would be good to look at whether when President Mutharika made a legal challenge, whether he was doing so as president of Malawi or as a leader of the Democratic Progressive Party, the ruling party at the time.
Yes, so for Mutharika, it was basically as the ruling party for TPP. So he was actually doing that in that individual capacity, not as the president of Malawi.
So what message do you think this is sending?
I think the clear message that is basically sending is that I think public officers, public institutions need to be very careful in the way they discharge their mandate, especially when they're making critical decisions around whether to go for a court litigation over an issue. Because looking at the background where we're coming from, the law is that the Malawi Electoral Commission was not supposed to appeal compared to Mutharika, who really was supposed to do that. And the court actually even confirmed in the Supreme Court that the Malawi Electoral Commission was not supposed to take that because it was being seen as a neutral referee. It was not supposed to be now being involved in the case. So I think it's a question around now that I think as a country we need to begin looking at these matters seriously, maybe beginning holding individual public officers on decisions that they make that have a greater bearing on the larger public in terms of now bearing the cost of the court.
Makumbo Mutale is the Malawi Governance Commentator. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The presidential candidate for the Opposition Alliance for National Transformation, ANT Party of Uganda, says opposition groups plan to defeat incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in next year's general election. Retired military general Mugisha Muntu says the lack of adequate preparation and strategic planning by opponents usually paves the way for the president to win elections. However, he says next year's poll will be different since opposition groups are determined not to lose lose and because they share public disgust at ongoing corruption, police brutality, intimidation, and harassment of opponents.
Well, the dynamics on the ground are in our favor and favor of change. The regime has really messed up in many areas, and the general desire for change within the population. Our main focus is how to organize the people, organize even those supporters of the regime, to recognize that we are a credible alternative political organization, and we are spending a lot of effort on that, and we see results in a number of areas where we are doing sampling in terms of the candidates that we've been getting at parliamentary level. And within the next 6 months of the elections, we believe we'll be able to turn the situation concretely in our favor.
There was a recent poll that showed that none of the presidential candidates could get the 50 plus one that the Constitution demands for a winner of a presidential election or election in Uganda. What role will your new party play in this call for unity among opposition groups or parties if your objective is to defeat President Museveni in next year's presidential poll?
The only way anybody could make that conclusion is if they read the situation as it has been the last several months, or possibly as it might be now. But we still have 6 months, and that's the whole issue of getting on the ground and organizing. And as you said, a week is too long in politics. So if we effectively go down and exploit the desire for change that there is in the country, we should be able to shift the situation in our favor, to the extent that we should be able to knock him out on the first round.
You remain so confident. However, President Museveni keeps winning election in Uganda, and his supporters from the NRM, the ruling party, say that he is unbeatable in spite of what you are saying, because the opposition seem to be divided.
He never wins because of his strength. He wins because of the manipulation that he does in the electoral process. Also, too, because of the organizational weaknesses on our own side as the opposition. And therefore, those are the ones that we need to tackle and overcome. Because where you find a situation where there is deep desire for change, if you're not well organized, yes, your opponent will still beat you, more so like those, the incumbent. But we have noticed a number of times, like in the by-election that we went through in the last 1 year, four of them, even which happened in the movement strongholds, we beat him in spite of the odds that were against us. How did that happen? Because we are well organized. And therefore, if we're able to replicate the organizational capabilities that we applied in those by-elections, we're able to apply them across the region, we'll be able to pull off a victory.
Retired Army General Mugisha Muntu is the presidential candidate for the Opposition Alliance for National Transformation Party of Uganda. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 11th. Lawyers for jailed Zimbabwe journalists Hopewell Chigono and Jacob Ngarabume, leader of the Transform Zimbabwe movement, say they have petitioned the High Court to intervene in restoring the duo's prison rights. Beatrice Mtetwa, lawyer for journalist Chigono, says authorities have denied the pair outside food, even though Zimbabwe law grants prisoners awaiting trial the right to bring their own food. The Zimbabwe Prisoners and Correctional Services says the measures are necessary to guide against the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. However, Mtetwa says that as a human rights lawyer, her job is to ensure that her clients' constitutional rights are respected.
On Saturday morning, we went to the maximum prison. They were brought to us in leg irons, and they were denied to have private interviews with the lawyers. They were denied all forms of food, it being said that they should eat prison food. And of course, in terms of Zimbabwe's laws, awaiting trial prisoners are entitled to bring their own food. They were denied warm clothing. So when we went back on Sunday, the same thing happened. We then started drafting an application to the High Court, which we have just issued, to try and have their rights to basic detention standards restored, like access to family, No member of their families has been allowed in. There was an attempt to limit the number of lawyers who could go in. Of course, COVID is being used as the reason for this.
What are the authorities saying about the coronavirus and your client? Because the prison authorities are saying that you want special treatment for your clients because of the coronavirus, and they are saying there are no special treatment.
Well, we have taken that to court because, firstly, at the facility where they were before they were moved, up to now, food is still being allowed. Visitors are still being allowed. Lawyers are allowed consultation in private. And the Remand Prison, where they were before, has a higher turnover of people from outside than where they are. So if corona was the real reason, it would mean that nobody actually can go to the Remand Prison because it has a very high turnover of inmates. So it simply does not make sense to us that they should actually give that excuse in respect of these two. But more importantly, there's no social distancing in prison. The prisoners inside are not given masks. They are only given masks when they are going to court. Internally, like where they are sleeping, they're not taking any of the precautionary measures that you would expect them to take if their real reason for moving them was related to the coronavirus social distancing guideline.
It seems to me that the prison authorities, I think I read a comment where they are telling you to be a lawyer and not to be an activist. What do you make of that?
It is very difficult to understand what being a lawyer and what being an activist is. As a lawyer who does human rights work, my job is to ensure that my clients' constitutional rights are respected. And where they are not respected, it is my job to go to court to enforce that. So bringing a court application to say respect the constitution is not activism at all. It is just what my job entails. It's just merely an attempt to ensure that the Constitution and its provisions are respected.
Beatrice, when is the next court date? When do you expect them again to go back to court?
Hopewell will be going to court on Wednesday for the continuation of the bail application that the magistrate refused to hear on Friday. Obviously, he was happy to have them stay in custody because today and tomorrow are holidays in Zimbabwe.
Beatrice Mtetwa is the lawyer for Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. As South Africa continues to ease coronavirus restrictions, technical and public health experts are working on plans to protect the health of the 14 million South Africans who rely on a network of minibus taxis to get to work, school, and more. Innovators and investors say this could be an African solution to a problem that affects millions of others in Africa and beyond. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The Humble Minibus Taxi is a lifeline for more than 70% of South Africa's workforce. The informally regulated system of vans, each seating about 14 passengers, is a mainstay in the nation's major cities and in its rural areas. But health experts worry this system is a breeding ground for coronavirus because of riders' close quarters and the high volume of passengers. A new South African nonprofit initiative, led by businessman Andile Ramaphosa, who is also the eldest son of President Cyril Ramaphosa, is trying to address this gap as the nation attempts to revive its economy after more than 9 weeks of strict lockdown, which started in March and has since eased off. He spoke to VOA via Google Hangouts.
Lockdown worked in this country in terms of reducing the spread of COVID. And it worked because people were not going anywhere. That was really great and allowed government to prepare and do all the things they need to do. When we insisted as business and as South Africans, let's open this economy, by not dealing with the commute, we basically undid what was happening with lockdown. So if you deal with the transport sector, because COVID is the virus that moves through the transport sector, if you deal with that effectively, you can actually put in an artificial lockdown through it. So for us, we saw that. We said, great. Okay, so we need to come up with solutions.
HIV researcher Dr. Jenny Pfeiffer-Kutsia, founder and director of the African Potential Foundation, says her team has come up with several solutions, ranging from simple to complex.
What we're looking at is a system very similar to what's being used in ambulances, and that is to adapt a UVC air filter that allows the airflow to be encouraged within the taxi using various fans within the filter, and air passes through the filter where it's then irradiated within a matter of seconds and is then transferred back out into the taxi to be circulated out within the taxi.
Her team is also considering an alarm system that alerts passengers to open the windows to allow fresh air to circulate, sanitizing stations that passengers can use to clean their hands before boarding, and a divider between the driver and passengers. These measures, say Ramaphosa's team, could decrease the risk of infection by up to 80%. So far, SDI has fitted out 5,000 school transport taxis and 1,000 commuter taxis at an estimated cost of about $340,000, much of it provided by donors. Andile Ramaphosa says it's been a steep learning curve, but a worthwhile one.
It's been quite a journey of discovery for us non-scientists to bring all these people together with one thing in mind. We need our people to get to work safely, and we need to save lives.
Pfeiffer Kutsia says the team is also looking at how to scale the model up to fit other African countries, which use similar transport systems to move millions of people each day. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new report looking at women incarceration in Sierra Leone, released last Monday, has revealed overcrowding, harsh punishment for petty crimes, and more human rights issues associated with female imprisonment. Isabella Kodua, a lead researcher of the legal group Advocate, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the findings.
What stood out to me, for instance, are some of the statistics that we found. For instance, 62% of the women we interviewed were in pretrial detention. Pretrial detention should be used as a measure of last resort. However, that wasn't the case in Sierra Leone, clearly, considering that so many were pretrial detainees. The problem with pretrial detention is that obviously it contributes to overcrowding. This is quite alarming, given that there's a pandemic and it spreads, you know, from being close to each other and maybe not having access to water, for instance, which was another problem that we found interviewing the women in prison.
When you say there was a lack of access to water, can you tell me more about those conditions within the prisons, and especially given that sanitary conditions are obviously very important to public health at the moment and always, really?
Yes. So, for instance, in the Freetown Correctional Center, which is in the capital, where most of the women in prison are detained, we found that it was severely overcrowded. In fact, it was initially built to hold about 18 women in prison, and it ended up holding more than 60 at a time. And we even found that some of the offices had been transformed into rooms. We found that some of the women were sharing a bed, so that was really significant considering the situation. And then on top of that, as I said, there was difficulty in accessing water. So even in the centers that were not overcrowded, which are pretty much all of the ones that are outside of the capital, even there, both the women in prison and the correctional center officers reported that there was oftentimes not enough water, and this obviously posed many problems in terms of hygiene and sanitation, especially for pregnant and menstruating women, for instance.
You know, in Sierra Leone, there is an ongoing problem of women being put in basically debtor's prison. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So, yes, about 34% of the women we interviewed had been imprisoned for economic or petty crime. And obviously, I mean, in general, I think when possible, there's a need for non-custodial measures to be put in place so that we have fewer women in prison. And, you know, obviously that reduces overcrowding and all of the problems we've already talked about. But more so for women who do not pose a public health and public safety problem, then there are many other options that should be developed in Sierra Leone. And for instance, community-based treatment, community-based diversion.
That was Isabella Kodua, a lead researcher with the legal group Advocate. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Northern Italy. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.